I've already been on my knees this morning. It should have been in prayer or worship or awe, or it was actually clearing up the sick that the cat had put all over the living room carpet. There's a way of humbling people, isn't there, and bringing things to reality. A couple of things. Just apologise to Terry. Terry, there are one or two visual things that I'm going to put up, and I apologise that some people might not be able to see that. Hopefully it won't detract from the message and Jesus speaks. A man was driving along a highway and he sees a rabbit hopping across the middle of the road. You might just have to, you might have to wind your mind back just a few years, particularly the women. The men might not get it at all, but the women might just have to go back a few years. This might be a slightly old story, but the rabbit hopping across the middle of the road, he swerves to avoid hitting it. But unfortunately, the rabbit jumps in front of the car and is hit. The driver, being a sensitive man, as well as, an animal lover, pulls out over and gets out to see what has become of the rabbit. Much to his dismay, the rabbit is dead. The driver feels so awful that he begins to cry. A woman driving down the highway sees the man crying on the side of the road and pulls over. She steps out of the car and asks him, "What is wrong?" "I feel terrible," he explains. "I accidentally hit this rabbit and killed it." The woman tells the man not to worry. She knows what to do. She went to her car and pulls out a spray can. She walks over to the limp, dead rabbit, bends over, and sprays the contents onto the rabbit. Miraculously, the rabbit comes to life, jumps up, waves its paw at the two of them, and hops off down the road. 10 feet later, the rabbit stops, turns round, and waves again. He hops down the road another 10 feet and waves. Hops another 10 feet, turns and waves, and repeats this again and again and again until he hops out of sight. The man is astonished. He couldn't figure out what could be in the woman's spray can. He runs over to her and demands, "What's in that can? What did you spray on that rabbit?" The woman turns the can around so that he can see. It says, "Hairspray restores life to dead hair." And adds, "Permanent wave." There is some relevance later. I'll make it that it's relevant, don't worry. Back at the end of July, those of us that were meeting in Millfield, while others were at Transform, a group that we fondly called the Remnant, we went through the first 8 chapters of Mark's Gospel. Not bad going, really. Well, I was quite impressed. We all stayed with that. And we covered off that story of the blind man that was healed. A great story, because the only evidence that we've got of Jesus not healing someone immediately the first time. Sometimes things don't become clear to us immediately, do they? But Jesus didn't leave the man like that. He healed the man again, so he could see perfectly clearly. We ended up right in the middle of Mark's Gospel. And at a critical point. And there are a few things about Mark's Gospel. Mark is far more impressed with what Jesus did than what he said. So it has a great enthusiasm for Jesus' miracles. Mark includes 18 miracles, about the same, similar to Matthew and Luke, which are longer. But it has only 4 parables compared to 18 and 19 in Matthew and Luke. The point being that Mark is full of action. The gospel, not lamb. I know you're thinking it. We have this interesting, I love it when the Bible brings different things together, but we have this setup that says Jordan on the left, that Mark's gospel starts at the lowest point on earth, the Jordan. And we get to the point, the passage that Jesus read, it ends heading towards very near the top of Mount Hebron, Hermon, which is the highest point in the Promised Land. So he's taken that time to go uphill. And then it's downhill from that point onwards towards Jerusalem. Bit of a roller coaster ride going on there somewhere. So we take 2.5 years to get to this point. Then the second half of Mark's gospel covers 6 months. In actual fact, the last bit covers a week. And then it covers hours and minutes. It's really zooming in on what's happening to Jesus. But it takes 2.5 years to get to there. And then we cover those chapters in that. Now, this place, Caesarea Philippi, is very important. Because this is the place where Jesus asked that question, who do you say that I am? And it's not the first time that the geography is important to the theology. So this was a place where in part of the mountain, the water just comes out from the mountain and starts the River Jordan. And it just appears out of the mountain. And it's got a sort of, it had a sort of superstitious context to it. And so people would put statues and things there. And one of those statues was Pan, a god who was believed to have appeared on earth as man. And then there was a statue of Caesar that Herod's son, Philip, had put there. Now, Philip clearly wasn't particularly backward in coming forward. So Philip, Herod's son, puts a statue of Caesar, and lo and behold, we have the place called Caesarea Philippi. Now, Caesar was a man who wanted to be God. And at that point, Jesus asked the question, who do you say that I am? It's an important, pivotal point. At this point, we have the first man to openly declare Jesus is the Messiah. So, anybody going to hazard a guess at who was the first woman to say Jesus was the Messiah? Martha. Martha. Now, I tried to work out, I'm not a good enough Bible scholar, I tried to work out, did Martha get in first? Was it a woman that first said Jesus was the Messiah? Now, I take David Paulson's word for it. He seems to be a better man than I am, and he says it was 2 weeks later. So, men, we can claim that one. I think we had the advantage with the amount of time that the men were spending with Jesus. But I can't help but think that this is a pivotal point. We've waited 2.5 years to get to this point in Jesus' ministry. He's established now with them that they understand he's the Messiah. What do you do next? Surely what you do next, what you say next, is critical. It's got to be important. You've taken 2.5 years out of a 3-year ministry to get to this point where you're going to say what you're going to say next. It's going to be important. And bear in mind, this is Mark's gospel. It's all about action. Very little teaching passages. Yet he spends the next 2 chapters teaching. Jesus teaches the disciples. Ooh. That's going to blow it. Mike, can you click on the actual PowerPoint slide, not the actual PowerPoint at all? I'm going to have to come back to that in a minute. So this next section, if Mark's gospel is about discipleship, this next section is about the cost of discipleship. And one commentator said, it is only after we understand the person of Christ that we appreciate his work. There's a theological lesson there for us. Quite often, we come... We come to this backwards. We know the end of this story. And I bet you have read the ending more than you've read getting there. And there'll be one or two of you who sometimes have a book and you can't wait to find out how it ends. So you read ahead and you get to the ending. These disciples have some sympathy for them. They did not know what was coming. So when Jesus starts telling them what's going to happen, no wonder they're a little bit surprised and struggle to take it in. But there is something to be learnt from 2.5 years of understanding who Jesus is, to be able to then believe and trust in what he did. To know the person of Jesus for all he did. The Jesus who did all those miracles, who fed the 5,000, in Mark's gospel he puts in the 4,000 as well, for good measure, who walks on water, but also the Jesus that is quite willing to touch the leper. The Jesus, as in the story we read, is willing to touch the eyes and spit in the eyes of the blind man. That if we understand that, then it brings a whole new life to what he did for us. If we understand who he was, what he was capable of, what he could do, and therefore what he could avoid, then when he goes ahead and does that, surely we come to it with a whole new amazement and a whole new awe of Jesus. Do we not follow a leader that we respect? Do we not follow a leader that we have learnt and seen something in them that says, yes, I'm willing to follow that? And sometimes I think we might miss out a bit because we come to Jesus because of what he did. We still need to understand who he is. We need to understand the glory of Jesus, and therefore we appreciate even more what he did. So this was just pointing out, I love some symmetry in the Bible, and this passage in the middle, these are called the passion predictions. So 3 times Jesus predicts his death to this group of disciples. And either side of it, he's proclaimed. And either side of that, he heals a blind person. I just love it when symmetry runs. So this period starts with a blind man being healed. It ends with a blind man being healed. It starts after that with declaration of Jesus as Messiah. It ends with a declaration of Jesus as the Son of David, the promised one. So it's only after we understand the person of Christ that we can fully appreciate his work. We need to understand Jesus. We need that relationship with him.
Oh. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." But they didn't understand what he meant, and were afraid to ask him about it. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all." He took a little child whom he placed among them. Taking the child in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me."
So, 3 passion predictions. In the region of Caesarea Philippi, Jesus emphasizes the necessity of his death. Going through Galilee, he emphasizes the certainty of his death. And on the road to Jerusalem, he describes the detail of his death and the suffering that he would have. So read the next passion prediction, the 3rd one.
Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise."
Gary, when he was breaking bread last week, talked about the anguish in the Garden of Gethsemane for Jesus, of realizing what he was about to go through. That he was, not only the pain and the suffering, but all the sins of those that had come before, those that were there, and those that were to come, i.e. us, was going to be laid upon him. And he carried that burden. But the thing is that I've come to realize from this is just how much more when Jesus knew that was coming. Jesus was announcing to them that these things were going to happen to him. Isn't the part of the agony when we fear something, the anticipation, the knowing it's going to happen? If you're like me and you don't like roller coasters, is it not that very long climb up that fills you with dread? To be honest, when you go over the top, that's over so quick, then you wonder when you get to the bottom why you were worried. But that long climb up, Jesus knew beforehand, and he suffered that anguish for all that time. That just gives me that much more respect, much more willingness to follow that leader. The 3 predictions have various things going on around them. Suffice to say, Plenty of mistakes from the disciples. So amidst Jesus saying, this is what's going to happen, you need to follow me, they're arguing about who's the greatest, they're arguing about what position they're going to get, they're arguing about all the things that they've given up to follow Jesus. Didn't really get it. In those three passion predictions, Jesus says this about the Son of Man, that he must suffer and die. He says he'll be betrayed and killed. He says that not only that, he'll be killed by Gentiles. The first prediction really focuses on him being rejected. Meaning rejected in this term means fail to pass the scrutiny. So those authorities, he failed to pass the scrutiny of them. We need to expect to be rejected as disciples. I'd rather fail their scrutiny than God's scrutiny. The second prediction is about Jesus being delivered. And there's a sense here of an action from God. This is not just being taken, but this is part of God's plan and he's delivered over. And the third one is about, if the action word perhaps is to hand, as in to hand over, he's going to be handed over to the Gentiles. Nothing worse for the Jews to know that their Messiah is going to be in the hands of the Gentiles. What does Jesus say about the kingdom in these three passion predictions? The goal of the kingdom is to lay down one's life like Jesus. The work of the kingdom is service, humility, good deeds, and warring against your own sin. And the leaders of the the leaders of the kingdom must be suffering servants. This is the kingdom. This is why I said this passage about is about the cost of discipleship. Now I'm going to play a short video. Let it speak to you as it speaks. Don't take it as great theology. It's not necessarily, it's not saying all things, but maybe just helps you to think about the cost of discipleship and taking up your cross.
Jesus' blood never fails me. Jesus' blood never fails me. Jesus' blood never fails me. Jesus' blood, Jesus' blood. Jesus' blood never fails me. Jesus' blood never fails. Jesus, the love.
I just think there's a sense in which we're called to take up our cross daily. If we do take up our cross in all its, whatever that means to us, means to you, then we have the ability to get over those problems that will be in our way to do so. We need to pick up our cross daily to be ready to face those problems. But you know, in all these predictions, there's some things in common. There's some progression in each of the passion predictions, new things added, something slightly different, to, you know, add a bigger picture, but there's some things that are exactly the same. And there's the same thing that the disciples failed to grasp in every one of those. And that was the resurrection. The resurrection is in every one of those predictions. Jesus never mentions dying and going to the cross as part of his predicting what was going to happen without also predicting he would rise again, and he would rise again in 3 days. Now, let's not be too harsh on the disciples. They had no understanding of what they meant. They had some understanding of resurrection on the last day. Jesus said he's going to rise in 3 days. They had no understanding of that. Still a bit worrying that when it happened, they still struggled to understand it. But Jesus had made it clear from this. Now, I love the way Mark reports these predictions. Short, sharp, he says, he will rise again. That's what he says. He will rise again. We've got to, that's got to fill us with faith, hasn't it? There are a couple of things here. Firstly, that none of this was a mistake. None of this was Jesus' path was interrupted. Jesus' plan, God's plan for salvation was changed, and Jesus had died and it was taken out of his hands. Jesus said, this is what's going to happen. And every time he did so, he said, I will rise again. That fills me with faith. Graham reminded us of Isaiah 53 last week, of Isaiah and his prophesying of things about Jesus, and mentioned 53. 53 says this: he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. So I ask, really trying to work out how I can get across this wonder of this long journey for 2.5 years of Jesus showing who he was before he raised that question, who do you say that I am? And then from that point on, telling them he was going to die and rise again. So what's for what purpose? Well, hopefully to increase faith. Knowing that the cross was not only necessary, but a certainty and planned and understood by Jesus as his path, increases faith. It's to increase understanding. The path of a disciple or follower is that of Jesus. It is to know who it is we follow and the nature of the journey. It has the cross before it. The passion predictions, and this is maybe hard to hear, the passion predictions are also a prediction of our passion, of our suffering, of our walk. To follow Jesus is to take up the cross. But as one person wrote, no cross, no crown. Maybe it's also to simplify. Sometimes we can get very in a bit of turmoil about our calling. And our calling is, in this case, made quite simple. It is to take up our cross and follow Jesus. Hopefully it is to encourage. At no point does Jesus, through these predictions, ever fail to state the cross is not the end. He predicts the resurrection. Maybe it's also to move us on. Passion is a strange word, isn't it? Especially in sort of today's context. Passion in this sense, in the passion predictions, is about suffering. And we particularly apply it to the last week of Jesus' life. Passion, we tend to think of as excitement, of great enthusiasm, maybe of lust, perhaps. But hopefully we move from the passion of suffering to the passion of following one who has been glorified and saved us. So maybe there's a link between those two meanings, that we end up with a passion to follow. I like this to just about finish with. Let us pause to gaze on that face and form, the Son of God, going with unfaltering step towards the cross. Does it not awaken us to new heroism as we follow? Does it not awaken new love as we see how voluntary was his death for us? Yet do we not wonder at the meaning and the mystery of that death? I just want to say that I love it when the Bible shows so much. Here we have a very special time when Jesus has sort of revealed to his disciples who he is, what he's like, and when they know who he is, he expresses to them what's going to happen to him, and he says, follow me. Let us know Jesus. I, for one, know what it is to know that there's a spray, and know what it is to resurrect, to know what it is to have resurrection. I know what it's going to be. It's going to be like I'm going to have eternal life because that spray is available to me through Jesus. Now, when you finish, I suggest you find people to give a hug to, because that spray had extra hold.